You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. The book China Doesn't Want You to Read, that's what CNN said, about Red Roulette, an insider's story of wealth, power, corruption and vengeance in today's China. It's the headline-making and best-selling tradition of Bill Browder's Red Notice, this unique memoir from an entrepreneur who rose to the zenith of power in 21st century China. What happened next was remarkable, shocking, and throws a disturbing light on what's happening over there. The book is called Red Roulette. It's by Desmond Shum. Delighted to be joining me on the line from New York, Desmond himself. Desmond, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Yes, very nice talking to you.
Good to have you with us. If we go back to the turn of the century between the 1990s and 2000, it seemed that China was somewhere we could do business with. There was a new spirit in China. Shanghai was booming. Hong Kong would seemingly go on as normal. This was the new superpower, and it had got away from that old, the shackles of Mao, and perhaps this was a China that the West could do business with. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you rose in this new China.
Well, I'm actually born in Shanghai, and my parents, I'm born in the tail end of Mao's era, right? I mean, the Cultural Revolution. And my parents took me to the Hong Kong when I was 10, and then because they feel that that's a better future for me if we get out of China. And I came over to the States for education and a college, and I went back to China right after. I started my career in private equity, which is the beginning of the era of private equity in the early 90s. And then subsequently, I moved to Beijing from Hong Kong in 1997, and I started my own career as an entrepreneur in 2000s, and early 2000s I met my ex-wife, and then we actually very soon, you know, get to know a wife of the premier Wen Jiabao, and he was a premier for China for a decade, and so right before Xi Jinping, so he was 2003 until 2012, he was a premier until, So Xi Jinping came to power at 2012. So a decade before that, he was a premier. So it's 2003 until 2012. And then we were business partner with Auntie Zhang, wife of the premier.
And describe to me what was like, because obviously, you know, from a European perspective, people are saying, right, you know, China is the new frontier. China is opening for business. Shanghai is an incredible city. It is like something out of a science fiction movie. These huge skyscrapers go up. And as opposed to saying, go west, young man, it seems to be a question of go east, young man. Now, but that was from the Western point of view. So as somebody who was already established there, obviously there were contact. Was it as exciting? And the possibilities were there for you, given your background?
It is. I mean, even, you know, I think the golden age, in, from my view, is of China is about starting from about 2000. I would say 1995, 98 period. That was a golden period. You know, I was in China. And you feel like everything is changing under your feet. You know, you're standing on quicksand. And then everything is possible and everything's looking up. And it is a very exciting period. I mean, you know, it's to be in the middle of it. And that's why I decided to try my luck as an entrepreneur at about 2000, which is when actually China just joined WTO.
Yeah. And I mean, as it said, people were talking about this market. I mean, we're not just talking about a couple, you know, a country. This is a huge market, and you could almost feel people sort of drooling at the possibilities. You'd got away from Hong Kong because that's a special circumstance, and found yourself in Beijing, and very quickly through your contacts. Was it air cargo? Was it an air terminal and also hotels? I mean, these were the big possibilities to build a business and make a fair amount of money too, Desmond.
Yes. So we met up with we get to know Auntie Jiang, and then subsequently, pretty soon, we get into business with her, and she's sort of runs the entire family affair of the Wen family when the husband is so busy running the country, essentially. And we, you know, China is today still it's 1/6 of global population, so 1 in 6 people is a human being on this earth is living in China. So it is a huge market.
You mentioned at the beginning, you know, you were born at the end of the Mao era. You know, I remember, because I am of a certain age, I remember Tiananmen and the crushing there. And so when China seemingly opened up for business, perhaps, you know, the West, as they've done in Russia, thought that this was a market. And if we brought market forces into China, then once again, a democracy would somehow develop. But of course, this isn't the case. And it is not so easy, or it's perhaps naive of people in the West to say, OK, if you get a market, then therefore, you know, human rights and will flourish. And also there won't be corruption. And if you look back at any history, of course, it's all families. It's always been families. And the Chinese Communist Party, using communist in parentheses, it is, again, mainly an elite, a family elite that looks after its own.
You cover a lot of areas in the situation in China. In terms of family, you know, I in a book I call them red blood, because I'm actually equivocating that with the blue blood from the West in the medieval times. Because this is a cross of people. We're talking a few hundred family, actually. So what does that mean? Is the elders in this in those families, they are senior party leader when the Communist Party take over China in 1949. Like just a simple example is Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping, his father is one of the top 10 general when they took over. In 1949. And when I say red blood, what does that mean actually in real life? I'll tell you what it means in real life. In real life is these people are born in a different section of a hospital. Their hospital section just reserved for them. If you're not vice minister, it's not money cannot buy you access. If you're not vice minister, both you would not have an access to that session of the hospital. And then they grow up at a different compound, which is only reserved for high power officials. And then they go into a different primary school. Their school catered only to them. And then they go to a different secondary school. And then they get fast track into the best universities in China. Now, Xi Jinping went to Tsinghua University, which actually I don't know about today because my book came out, but I was the honorary trustee of Tsinghua University. And but on a daily basis, they got a separate food supply system. So their farmland, they just grow food supply for them. I mean, we're not talking about you're picking the best foods supply off the market and ship it to them. I'm talking about farmland just reserved growing their food. Even the liquor they drink is marked on the bottle. These liquor are for them. I mean, you have a cross of people who live above the crowd in China, and they rule China, and then their offsprings rule China, like Xi Jinping.
So presumably, if you want to become successful in China, you have to, shall we say, get on, make a petition or give gifts. If I go in as a Western investment bank to China or a venture capital firm, I have to presumably bring on somebody from that elite as a director, or put them on my board, or if I'm an investor, I'm building a series of skyscrapers in Shanghai or whatever. You have to make the right permits and the right approaches to these people to get anything done. Then, Desmond.
Yeah, China is well known. We all call China what? A party state. What does that mean? That means the party cell, the cell of the party is infiltrate every cell of the society. So when I say you need to pay up to power, you need to pay up to political power, I don't mean just big business. I mean every business. So if you are a person running a newspaper stand in the street corner, you need to pay up to the party boss who run your section of the street. And the bigger your business is, you have to further go, you go to further up. I mean, and every business, I mean, no exception. I mean, obviously, in our case, we get all the way to the family of the premier. But if you, like you just mentioned, like Western banks, right? It is well known. And then you go on the internet, you will say one of the very, very famous case is J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan, and they're fined by the United States government. They hire this red blood princelings and in the investment banking division in order to get business from the large state-owned enterprises.
And presumably, because it is controlled and it is China and they have a fearsome and ferocious security infrastructure who do the bidding of the red bloods, there is very little opposition, and any opposition is crushed, like we see with, for example, the Uyghur. I don't want to get involved with the whole Uyghur thing, but we see the way that, and I've interviewed people who have been detained in Chinese camps, and we see the way that they have a very, should we call it an effective way of crushing any opposition?
I think, you know, I was interesting. I was talking to a journalist in Hungary yesterday, and then Hungarian journalist. And, the communist states and dictatorships states run things very differently. Are very similarly. I mean, they're always almost, exactly the same philosophy, but come from them. The output, first of all, the party want to make sure that, especially in China, that is no organized opposition. So they want make every individual and the actor in the society with very limited cohesion to other members of the society. So, Uyghur is one thing, that's an ethnic group, religion. Right, I mean that if you go on video, you will see they burn down churches. The Catholic Church is sponsored by the state. Essentially, Xi Jinping's word is more important than the word of the God, even in China's Catholic Church. So they want to, and then they encourage people to rap on each other, so to distrust this trust of bonding among people. So every person is individualized as an atom. So as a party, we all well know how pervasive the Chinese the CCP's monitoring is on every individual, and that's how they want to run the society. Obviously, that's essentially you have a system against one single individual, then you can crush any possible opposition.
Mm. And I suppose, again, I go back to this naivety of the West who got involved, because they didn't understand, the centuries-long game that Chinese society has had. Because, as Westerners, we are taught very little about China. As a British person, I'm taught very little about China until what we would call, the Opium Wars, the Boxer Rebellion, etc. So the West tends to underestimate China, and they do it at its peril. And so China was happy to, the Red Bloods were quite happy to transfer from a nationalized industry to the new markets because it generated more money for them. But at the end of the day, they were just interested in gaining more benefit, be it financial power, be it property, but as long as they keep themselves secure and keep that dynasty secure. What was it like when it was good for you because, you know, private jets, houses. I mean, we were, you know, we were fed this image of Shanghai with people driving Mercedes Benz, playing golf, you know, country clubs, tennis, and this whole new, what we were being told was this whole new wave of Chinese millionaires who were going to come and you know, go on holiday, even here in Spain to play golf. They would, you know, they would travel half the world, and on the surface it looked like this was going to turn into you know a new financial paradise. What was it like for you when it was good?
I think let me just go back and talk about the first session of what you just talked about. Yeah. I think it's not just the West underestimate; it's a bulk of we Chinese in China also underestimate. Because what happened with China's 1979, it was, you know, we always talk about 1979 as the beginning of China's economic liberalization. What actually happened was in 1979, the state was absolutely bankrupt. So that's why they have no choice but let the peasants to grow some crops the market wants, let small business to open the shop to sell something, make something the market wants. It's not because they wish on it, they want to loosen the control. It's they have no other choice because the state was absolutely bankrupt. And the subsequent growth and all that, it gave the power, it gave more money to the power, the red bloods, you give power to the red bloods, and then they go with it. And then I think, you know, obviously that's West that have made a wrong assumption of their wishes in the long term. A bulk of the Chinese, we are in China, also make the wrong assumption. We thought that's going to go on. Mm. We thought that's, you know, one day we will be more like you. You know, when I mean you, I mean the West, you know, democracy, liberty, human rights and all that. So it's just not you. And we all underestimate their desire, absolute desire to hold on to power and to control, you know, to control the, you know, essentially control 1/6 of humanity. So that's one thing. And the second part of what you just talked about is like, what are the good days? I'll just give you a simple number. When I start business, going to China early 90s, a very successful private business will be making a revenue of 2-3 million US at today's exchange rate. Obviously, today, the richest, I mean, not even the richest, I mean, China, you know, at one time it's almost on par with the U.S. in terms of number of billionaires in China, right? And then today, obviously, the richest Chinese are tens of billions. So there's a period of for all of us, including myself, money just gushing in, right? You're looking at, like, who is buying a private jet? And then at one time I was talking to you know, the jet company is like, I want to buy the latest one. I was G550. There's a line to it, you know, the good days. And then it's like, can I jump the line, right? You know, can I find a way to, who do I need to know, you know, Chinese, you know, it's like, where's the Guanxi part? Who is the leader of the Guanxi? I can jump the line to buy the jet, right? That period of time. It's just like, you know, much, you know, I just give you another example. It's a widely reported anyway. In New York Times, we invest insurance company, the Ping An Insurance, which today is the second largest insurance company. We invest about 2004. And we invest about 10 million US, and it become over 200 million US by 2008, 2009. You know, you just look at that scale, right? It's just that's exponential growth of wealth. And then it is, I'm not the only one having that, you know. So that is a period of that.
You were working with your wife. You and your wife split, and you at some point with your son decided, and correct me if I'm going wrong, moved presumably what to the States, moved out of China.
We're in the UK actually.
Okay, to the UK. Presumably, you still had the business interests, but you were just managing from the UK. I mean, why did you decide to leave China at that, you know, previous to say the mid teens. So 2015,
2016. Yes, we did plenty of investment business, but bulk our business in the real estate. So we, you know, we just example, you know, we developed the Beijing Airport's logistic facility, which is the biggest logistic facility in the entire China. So you probably make it one of the bigger one, one of the biggest in the world. We did a Bulgari Hotel of Beijing. We own a Bulgari Hotel of Beijing. And then, you know, so all sort of things. So actually, by the early days of Xi Jinping, one is I already seeing the return of the real estate business as it's going down. And then in some segment of the real estate business, you can see the returns collapsing. And then obviously the politics, you know, very early on in Xi Jinping day, you see the politics is going a different way. So me and my ex-wife, Whitney already split, and then I was actually closed by business. It took me 3 years to close down the business. So I actually entirely closed the business and I move out. And I advised Whitney to do the same thing, and she believed her political connections will carry on and she can do what she have done in the past. And she decided to stay.
Mm. And then you had this nightmare situation in 2017 where Whitney and three co-workers just disappeared.
Yeah, yes.
Any warning, any sign, or was this literally one day there was there were no phone calls, there was no messaging? Was it just literally bam, gone?
If there is any warning, so 6 months before she disappeared on that day, which is almost exactly to the day, she was disappeared on September 3rd. And she 6 months before that, she was barred from leaving the country. So she was locked down in China 6 months before. But what happened was on that day, bam, gone. I mean, when we say disappear, I mean, yeah, literally like nobody heard anything from her, including her parents, for 4 years. And the government never acknowledged taking her. And, you know, now today, you know, 2017, but now it's like 5 years from now. She never been charged, just never been acknowledged by government. She had been taken by the government.
It is. It's shocking, isn't it? And obviously you're in Europe, you're in London or wherever you are. And it must have been impossible to try and, because we talked about that security situation in China. People just fall off the radar. I mean, terrifying that somebody at that level, you would think, could just disappear and then reappear.
Yes. It's so widely reported for Jack Ma, the quote-unquote the richest person in China, was disappeared for 6 months, right? So it is not an uncommon thing to happen to business person. Really, I mean, situations like that, you always have, you know, this has to do with internal high-power politics in China. And obviously, that's no, you know, human rights or private property protection to speak of. You know, everybody need to bow in front of political power. What happened in China reappearance was my book came out, you know, September 5th. So it's almost exactly a year to the day. And I picked the day because to commemorate the fourth anniversary of the disappearance. So the book was coming out on Tuesday. And then the Friday before, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times published articles about my upcoming book. That was, and on Saturday, she called my mom and asked me, because of the time difference, she called my mom and asked me to call her back. That's the first time anybody in the world have heard from her in 4 years. And then she called to ask me to stop the book from publishing.
Hmm. Yeah. I wonder why exactly. How do you pick up the phone and say, you know, I mean, what do you say to somebody who's been gone for 4 years? You haven't heard a thing. And then you get a message like that. It must have been a terrible situation because you've written this book. You want it to get out there, but you know, she was in China at this point, I presume. And obviously the Chinese government are trying to, you know, as we've seen them do with tennis players, with whatever, to try and keep the official narrative going that everything is fine in China.
Yes, I think the two things I want to pick up what you just said. The first thing is, you know, for sure is the government get wind of it. I mean, she has been isolated and gone for 4 years. She can't possibly know, you know, from the Wall Street Journal or Financial Times that my book is coming. It's the government get wind of it, saw the news, hand her the phone, say, this is the message I want you to send. I mean, if she had a free access to the phone, she would talk to her mom, you know, many months ago. I mean, I'm very unfortunate, her, you know, Whitney's mom passed away 6 months before she was reappeared, actually. So it is, and so we both know on the first call, I think, I definitely know, I mean, that call is being taped, recorded, listening. If not, somebody's sitting right across from her, then they give her a paper, said, this is the message you need to send. So it's very difficult in that kind of situation. And even in a subsequent calls we had, to actually have a real communication, because you know you'd be listening. You know whatever she's saying, she's cautious and she's aware of what to say.
I won't, you know, we won't tell the whole story of the book because we want people to go and buy it, yeah, and buy it and everything. And obviously, yeah, yeah, this is coming out in paperback, which is why we are speaking. But one thing strikes me, Desmond, because of the influence that China has around the world, if you write something like this,
yes,
and you're sitting, you know, anywhere in the world, we know how far China's influence is. Yes. We know they have investments in Africa and in South America. That, yes, I mean, surely for yourself, I mean, are you, you know, and your son, are you not a little worried about this? Or do you think it is more important to let people know the situation that really exists over there?
What China wants, the CCP wants, is they want, as you were mentioning, they want to control the narrative of China. They want to be the only storyteller of China. Anybody deviates from the narrative, they punish you and they silence you. So that's what was it about. And in my case, I just thought, you know, a lot of it, for me, writing the book and publishing is two separate decisions, actually. I didn't write a book to publish. I write a book to give it to my son as a gift, trying to explain to my son, to our son, what happened, why her, you know, his mom is gone. That was why I was writing it. I published it because after 2 years into her disappearance, I got just really angry. I was like, I need to come out and tell the world what our story is. I need to bring attention to her case. I mean, by, you know, in 2 years into her disappearance, nobody heard from her. The government never acknowledged taking her. We don't even know whether she's alive or dead. You know, I mean, you know, bringing a book about bringing attention to her case, I mean, it's like, what worse can possibly happen to her? We don't even know whether she's alive. So that's why I decided to publish the book subsequently. Into my own situation, you know, once I decided to go, that's why I you know, I didn't write a book to publish, because I don't want to bring them like the heat on me from the CCP. You know, this is a, you know, ruthless political party with 90 million members. But once I decided to publish it, I sort of throw this concern behind me and move forward, because if they want to do something, that's absolutely nothing I can do, right? I mean, this is a political party controlling the country, which is the second largest economy of the world. They have 90 million in the party. What the heck, you know, a person like me, a single individual, can possibly defend myself? There's just no way. And I don't want to live in fear for the rest of my life. So I just, you know, I just throw those fears away and then out of the window and then say, well, come here one may. This is what I'm going to do. And this is the way I'm going to live my life. And come here one may.
The book is called Red Roulette, an insider story of wealth, power, corruption, and vengeance in today's China. It's by Desmond Shom, who we've been speaking to today. Desmond, you're an incredibly brave person. Thank you for taking the time to speak to me today. If people want to, do you have a website? Do you do the social media thing? Can they find you online? Or can they download?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I mean, it's a pleasure to talk with you. I mean, I think if you search just Google anything, I give Google my name, a lot of things will come up. I don't really run a sort of puppet media life for myself, but you will find a lot of things online.
Well, congratulations on the book. It's coming out in paperback today. Came out on paperback yesterday. It's called Red Roulette. It is by Desmond Shum. Desmond, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.